All right, good morning, everybody, and welcome, welcome, welcome to the Journey Home with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And here we're going through the book by Dr. Kenneth Wapnick called The Journey Home, and it's based on the Obstacles to Peace from A Course in Miracles, Chapter 19. And I do believe we're starting a new chapter today.
We are. Chapter 5.
Chapter 5. And really
we went through the 3 introductory chapters and the first obstacle, the attraction of guilt. Now we're on to the second obstacle, the belief the body is valuable for what it offers.
Ooh. Boy, I'll tell you what, that's a biggie, okay?
Oh, yeah. We
that is a biggie.
We think there's some kind of payoff or some kind of, you know, benefit to identifying with the body, you know, and right.
It's not so true, huh?
it's just that it's only valuable in an illusory system of values.
Exactly, why do we want that? You know, today we got the gift of Christ, and, you know, why wouldn't we want just that? You know, why would we want all this other crap going on here? But now there we go.
Well, and then of course there's the, I'm sure you guys Ken will discuss as we get into it, the whole idea that the world is nothing. The universe is nothing. And the only thing that is real is our relationships. To clarify, the universe and the world of separate things and separate values and separate interests and special separate stuff that can't be shared in the mind but appear to be able to be shared on the level of form. But those are still just dreams that we have something that others don't have or vice versa, and you know, the only bodies can seem to have, you know, different things in mind. In truth, we're all the same being, just dreaming that we have these different experiences and different existences and different identities. And that's a pretty challenging idea, because the world that we made, because our minds are so powerful, is so convincing. And so it takes us a while, doesn't it, to recognize that, you know, there's something more as we've, you know, crawled so far down the rabbit hole of our imagination in a massive dream that it takes a while to remember and realize that, you know, there's got to be more to it than this. There must be a better way.
Yep, exactly. And you know what the funny thing is once you start recognizing that and knowing that, you recognize that you've kind of known that all along.
Exactly.
You know, from the beginning, you know, I've known, you know, since I was a child, you know, I understood there is something else happening here. And yet, you know, the world kind of, well, I can't say that the world knocked that out of me. What happened was, I believe the stories that the world told me, and by believing those stories, I believed I was something else. I would believe that I was something other than what I was. And it's interesting. I just, you know, got off a call, and we do the lesson of the day on Saturday morning, and just got off that call, and we were talking about the memories that we have from our lifetime, of times when we felt holy, and times when we felt connected. And, you know, I've done quite a bit of work on that myself, because, you know, I recognized that the things that I've reaffirmed in myself over and over and over again throughout my life have been the things that said I was not holy, and that there was something wrong, and I was not doing what I was supposed to be doing, and the world was a big mistake. And, you know, I have all these memories that tell me that, you know, all that is true. And so coming to the place where I can remember that, you know, what I am, and I can remember that God loves me, and I can remember that the holiness of myself is a pretty big deal. And, you know, you've had those experiences your whole life, and yet, you know, we don't remember those. We remember the things that were bad.
Yeah, exactly. We have a very, very selective memory. You know, I went on to a little mental riff when you said not holy to lumber grades. I remember building a house and learning about, you know, number two, number three, number one, select structural grades of lumber when I was building a house years ago. And one of the highest grades is what's called clear heart, where there's no knot holes. So it's not holy. And then I think, well, what makes a knot hole? Well, it's when you mill a tree and where there's a limb that shoots out, you know, when there's a branch or a separation, if you will, or a diversion, or a duality that happens in a singular trunk. And just playing with we're doing wordplay with that. I'm also going to be talking about the role of words in healing tomorrow night in the School for A Course in Miracles immersion class. Anyway, that'll be fun. So, it's you know, we think that we are not holy. We think that we're the home of evil, darkness, and sin.
Right? We've got a bunch of knot holes in us.
We've got a bunch of knot holes, yeah. We're just not a clear heart piece of lumber here.
Well, and when you say that, clear heart, that is really what? The center of the tree where there are no knots. The heart of the tree.
Exactly.
Where there are no knots. So,
there are not knots, and this is a course in not know.
No, that's right.
And the ego's insane curriculum is not K-N-O-W, to not know. Yeah, but the not know, that not N-O of the Holy Spirit's curriculum is basically saying no to ego's negation and choose the joy of God instead of pain, as Ken is about to share in the writing he has here. Should we dive into it? I have a quick announcement. Maybe I already made this last week, but just in case, and it'll be further announced. I put a short video up on ACI blog. I'm recording with Doug Sparks of Boulder, Colorado, who is in a few days on his way back to Ajijic, Mexico, where he'll be for a good while. And he's at the end of January giving another workshop there on A Course in Miracles. And the one he gave previously was on gratitude and forgiveness and shared interests and interesting topics like that. This next one, he's actually going to spend 4 days going over just the What It Says, which is really only about 3 or 4 pages in the preface of A Course in Miracles, and spend 4 days at a workshop near Lake Chapala, Mexico, talking about that last weekend of January. So if anybody's interested, we'll have more details on DougSparksACIM.com, his website, and I'll post those also on ACIMblog.com as well. And, there's also, I think since we last talked, maybe not, but anyway, there's new videos on the ACIM.org events page. So if anybody hasn't checked those out, really good.
Excuse me, I'm so sorry. Okay. Thank you for that. And also, I also wanted to make an announcement. As you all know, we've had a Disappearance of the Universe Yahoo group for 16 years.
Yeah.
Starting in 2003, and we had received a message like a month ago. It seems like now from Yahoo that they're going to discontinue the groups, and so I had to find another place and did find a place on IO groups, io.groups, and they're going to. It took an amazing amount of things to go through, hoops to jump through, to get this thing so that I can. It's actually going to transfer all of our site, all of our messages. There are 91,000 messages on that board.
Wow.
from the last 16 years. And, of course, I've only been on it for 15. I started in 2004. So, you know, I'm kind of a latecomer, but.
So you got a whole year's worth of messages to catch up on in your spare time.
That's right. but no, I already caught up on those when I first joined the group. And, what's so amazing about it is that group, that Disappearance of the Universe group, was started in 2003 by a guy named, Nelson Young. And Nelson, I never knew Nelson. Actually, he was not even posting by the time I got onto the group. And apparently he started the group as a book discussion group about the disappearance of the universe. And then he left it, you know, not too long afterwards. But he was actually the original owner of the group. And so for all these years, you know, we've been using this group. And when it came time to switch it over, only the person who was the original owner of the group could do, you know, certain things. And so I actually went back to the very beginning and found his email address from, like, 16 years ago and sent him an email and said, you know, we got a problem and I need your help. And he responded immediately to me. He still had the same email address. He responded immediately to me, and we got into a discussion conversation, and he did what needed to be done to be able to transfer the group, and then he friended me on Facebook. And so now, Nelson Young, I said, you know, you have always been kind of a mystery to me, and I've always wondered about you. And turns out he's an engineer. He says, you know, we have a lot in common. I'm an engineer too, and you know, I believe in you know, this whole you know, science and spirit all having the same message. And so it was very, very cool. It was like so cool. So now we're just waiting. It's going to take a while because the IO groups, a lot of Yahoo groups, are going over to it. And I had to pay $220 to make that happen. And I was like, oh my gosh, you know, I don't have $220. So I just sent out a message on the forum and said, you know, I need $220. And actually what was, people started donating through PayPal. And so actually how much I got donated was $211. And so I was able to go ahead and do it. And, you know, I was worried, oh, what's going to happen if they send me more money? Then, you know, I'm going to have to send them back money and all that. But no, they sent me, you know, $211. So all I had to do was fork out $9 on my own. But it was just an amazing, amazing situation. And it just goes to, you know, what this Course in Miracles you know, does. And, you know, I asked the question when it first came up, you know, am I invested in this group? Do I really want to keep this group? You know, what is the, you know, and nobody else, you know, Gary Renard, you know, wasn't saying anything. Nobody else was saying, you know, here's about a lot of members were saying, yes, please, you know. And all these years for the last, gosh, it must be the last 10 or 11 years, I have sent out the lesson of the day every day to that group. So every day I send out the lesson. And so many people said, you know, I depend on getting that lesson on my email so I can, you know, look it on my phone and I have the lesson of the day every day. I never realized what an impact that was. And there's almost 6,000 members of that group. So I thought, you know, well, gosh, and most of these people are not paying attention. But actually, people are paying attention, and people do like getting the lessons. And
I always look forward to getting an email,
So it's a...
And sometimes I've already read it, but it's just kind of like a quick reminder, oh, yeah, that's right, that's today's lesson. Then it kind of anchors it in my mind again, you know. So, yeah.
It's amazing, and what a gift to be of service. You know, that's such a gift to me to have that ability to be of service. And, you know, that's what I think about this room, too, ACIM Gather for A Course in Miracles.
Yeah.
Is when Dov was sick and had cancer and was not able to really carry on for a while, you know, I felt it was really important to keep it going. And so,
yes,
you know, I jumped in, and that's why I'm doing what I'm doing now. It's just, again, what a gift. I didn't start it. You know, we didn't start the fire. It was always burning. But I certainly am a tender of the fire. And,
and your contributions are greatly appreciated, not just by me, but by thousands of others, yeah, easily. Yeah.
I know, thousands.
That's pretty cool. I mean, that really is. You know, everything about
it is pretty cool, and yeah, I'm so grateful. And good morning, Carrie. I'm glad to see Carrie in the room. Being out in California and probably not having power half the time. So,
some parts have been, out for several days. In fact, Tara, who's one of the, she's actually the moderator for these new Let's Discuss ACIM webinars, videos that are being recorded. When I talked to her the other day to, you know, arrange when the next few were going to be recorded so I could help with the YouTube and work and so forth. She said, yeah, we've been out without power since Saturday, and that was like Tuesday. So it's like, that's a long time to go without power. So wishing stamina and patience and forgiveness to everyone in those situations. Yeah.
I know. My gosh, what a gift, though. You know, it'd be like living in the olden days. I don't know, Carrie, if that's how it is with you, but it's, you know, like you got to figure out a way to stay warm and cook your food and, mm-hmm. you know, keep your phone charged. And
can always go to my brother's site, survivalblog.com, and learn about a whole bunch of different self-sufficiency technologies there. And if you're interested in that sort of thing.
You know, that's so funny, Bruce, because I am a survivalist. I have been since the 60s when, you know, uh-huh. I had this idea that there was going to be a revolution and we were going to have to run to the hills. And I, you know, talk about your Mother Earth News and the Whole Earth Catalog. Do you remember the Whole Earth Catalog?
Sure.
You know, I was into all of that, and, you know, I learned how to, you know, I could do anything, really, basically. You know, I got my Joy of Cooking that tells me how to, you know, cook a bear or...
Is there a recipe for bear?
You will not, if you ever see the Joy of Cooking... Check it out.
I didn't realize that.
There is how to prepare these things. It's a pretty amazing book.
Well, I hope the bear version doesn't have how to cook a human. Into our cannibalistic thought system. I have to probably get into it in a few moments here. Inexorably back to the topic at hand. It's interesting because, you know, it's so easy to get hung up in the, you know, survival at the expense of. So I've actually been a ghostwriter on that blog. My brother has a survival blog, and I haven't for a few years, but I wrote a number of articles on photovoltaics and small hydro and food storage and, you know, self-sufficiency kinds of stuff, but always with the idea in mind of, the idea is, you know, shared interests. You know, how can we take care of ourselves so that we can take care of others, as sort of a, you know, let's generalize it to the shared interests of everyone having enough and being enough and you know, that sort of thinking anyway. So I try to steer away from the, you know, at the expense of or the adversarial aspects that inevitably come into a dualistic thought system, no matter what it is. I mean, you know, A Course in Miracles is not exempt from that, and that, you know, there appear to be, you know, different factions within, and I probably shouldn't go into that within the Course community about what it means, and you know, is it all one thing or is it multiple things? And if we identify with the differences, we're saying the dream is real and there's something to defend. And I think it kind of actually ties into what we're going to read about.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, once you get the idea that it's all the same, and you know what your brother is into, and I've looked at your brother's website, is very good. You know, it's, of course, there's paranoia, but, you know, who lives in this world who's not paranoid? You know, if you don't think that there's a possibility that things can go wrong and you need to survive. You know, just talk to the people in Puerto Rico or, you know, California now, people that who have had, you know, had to figure out how to survive without all the modern, you know, whatever, accoutrement. And believe me, you know, it's helpful to have something
it,
like
it, that. It was challenging just for me to share my wife's computer for a week. Mine was in the shop.
I'll bet.
And I spent another week rebuilding it when I you know, wasn't practicing what I preached in terms of technology. So anyway, okay, yeah. So all these lessons in forgiveness, which are ultimately lessons in self-forgiveness, huh? So anyway, yeah, just before we move on, thank you, Lynn, for all that you've done with ACIM Gather and with the DU Yahoo group over the years and probably countless other things that I'm not even aware of. So anyway, I think the course community at large is very grateful for all your efforts in both historically and ongoing. So kudos to you.
Thank you so much. And yeah, well, tell you, it's all self-interest. So
yeah,
I absolutely,
right.
yeah. I do it because I need it. Otherwise, I wouldn't.
Yep.
But I was just looking at the Joy of Cooking has an expanded, and this is the one that I know, expanded thing that tells you how to cook opossums and bears and squirrels.
The roadkill glossary.
Yeah, pretty much so. But and in fact, I have a really funny little short story. I don't want to go, but a friend of mine. Let's see, opossum, bear, raccoon, muskrat, woodchuck, beaver, and peccary. It has recipes for. But a friend of mine.
I thought they could say they walked into a bar.
No. A friend of mine, Wade Knutson, who is Susie Braverman's husband, okay. When he was a kid, he was like 16 and he ran away from home. They're Canadian,
okay.
By the way. So he ran away from home and he went down to the docks and he got a job on a ship on a tugboat as a cook. And you know, these boats that bring things up and down, you know, it's a pretty, you know, quite a life for people. But he was 16, uh-huh. And he hired on as a cook, and he did not know how to cook. He had no idea how to cook. But they took him, they showed him the kitchen, they said, you know, here you go, the kitchen on the boat. And so, you know, he's like, well, what the hell am I going to do now? And he looked over in the corner, and there was a copy of The Joy of Cooking. And he said, I saw a book, and it said, How to Cook. And and I took that
quick
book.
Study time. Huh?
And he did. And he cooked. He was a cook on that boat for a long time, I guess, before his family discovered where he was and made him come home. Because he stole his dad's car. That was how they figured out where he was, because he found his car down there by the docks and you know, figured out eventually that he was on a boat. But anyway, it saved his life. He said, that book saved my life.
Wow, that's good.
That is pretty funny.
I have a similar, very short story of when, about a decade ago, a friend of mine who was living in Oregon here, but has since moved back to California where we met, he said, hey, Bruce, I could get you a job as a process improvement consultant if you read this small stack of books in the next month. And I said, okay, sure, I'm game. And it was basically a process improvement, a value stream mapping and all that kind of stuff for it's used in industry, but also in the military. And this job was an ongoing assignment to an Air Force base. And I got the job through a phone interview, not even one in person, and based on my friend's recommendation, and was enjoying doing this job for about two and a half months after a month of training, flying back and forth every week, and then the lieutenant colonel decided they needed someone with a military background, which my dad had, but I didn't, so it was like out the door. But it was fun while it lasted. So I learned a lot about not only, you know, life on an Air Force base, but also compassion for the people who serve our country, you know, and recognition that we're all the same, you know, because I had some distorted ideas, and a belief in differences and separation, you know, basically. And it's like, you know, everyone has the same, you know, as Ken Wapnick keeps coming, you know, back to remind us to see, we have the same three components. We have a decision-making faculty, and we use that to choose every moment between the thought system of separation, which is the ego, or the thought system of inclusion, which is the Holy Spirit. And that's really our progress through and out of the dream, is really just making a more consistent choice for the thought system, the Holy Spirit, which is undoing the belief in separation.
Exactly. And I thought when you were saying, Ken, that you were going to say, be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a hard battle.
Exactly. Yeah, he quotes that a lot, too.
Yeah, I think he
was attributed to Philo and then another, I think
Plato. Plato or Philo.
Yeah, I think it's one other guy, too. But anyway, it doesn't matter.
It's true.
Who gets the credit is sort of part of the second obstacle, I think.
That's right. You get the credit. Yeah. We get the credit. All right, so you want to start reading?
Sure.
All right.
So chapter 5 is the second obstacle, the belief the body is valuable for what it offers. So a large topic here, again, too, just as the first obstacle, which is the attraction of guilt, was covered a lot of pages. So Ken begins to summarize the first obstacle to peace. Oh, now he's going to redo it. The first obstacle to peace addressed our grievances and the ways in which we attack each other. We discuss this obstacle in light of the ego's strategy of protecting its belief in sin by projecting it out and accusing others of what we secretly accuse ourselves of doing. As the workbook says, now he's quoting from workbook lesson 134, paragraph 9, when you feel that you are tempted to accuse someone of sin in any form, do not allow your mind to dwell on what you think he did, for that is self-deception. Ask instead, would I accuse myself of doing this? Ken continues, moreover, the meaning of attack within this ego strategy is that holding grievances defends against sin. Yeah, good luck with that, right? This, in turn, is the ego's defense against the son's changing his mind, reinforcing his mindlessness, and preventing him from choosing against the ego's thought system of individuality and specialness. Any comments on that? He's already covered a lot, as usual.
Already, right away. And that's what you have to remember. It's the ego strategy that holding grievances defends against sin. So the ego strategy says, I have to protect myself. And the ego strategy says, these others are attacking me in some way. And when Jesus says, ask instead, would I accuse myself of doing this? Well, no, I wouldn't accuse myself of, you know, trying to wreck the country and destroy democracy. And I wouldn't accuse, well, you know, actually, I do accuse myself of these things. And you know, I accuse myself because of my negligence. You know, here comes the guilt when I see that other people seem to be doing things and I'm accusing them of the bad things that I think I see. Any time that I accuse my brother of doing something wrong, I am going to experience guilt. And that experience of guilt is not because I think I'm doing bad things, but because I'm allowing bad things to happen. I'm not stopping bad things from happening. I'm not saving the whales. I'm not whatever it is that I accuse my brother of, you know, I'm not, what am I doing to stop these things? And so I see myself as guilty too, even though I'm helpless, appear to be helpless, in the midst of all of it. I still can't reconcile allowing what I perceive as suffering to go on without doing everything within my power to stop it or prevent it or heal it or whatever. And the problem is that, you know, the ego has no idea how to do any of these things. The Holy Spirit does. And the Holy Spirit's gift is that we can look at these things and forgive them. And by forgiving them, forgiving what I think I see is wrong, looking at it and recognizing nothing has gone wrong, nothing bad is happening, and all of these things are part of a dream, you know, then, you know, I can stop accusing my brother or myself of doing anything wrong. So stop thinking about what you think is going wrong and look at what you're accusing, how you're attacking your own self, and recognize that the only way to heal is to let go of both of those things. Both of those things. My attack on my brother and my attack on myself.
Exactly, yeah. Which are really synonymous, and but that only makes sense when we embrace the pure non-duality of the Course, and we don't usually do that directly. We generally do that by recognizing that we're not at peace when we're making any kind of, you know, condemning comparison or judgmental attack on anyone or anything, and realizing, well, that I don't feel peaceful when I'm doing that, you know, and then just letting that go, and just realizing, you know, over time, if we can do it with little things, we can apply it to the larger things that seem more challenging. Yeah, the Course tells us they're really all the same, because there's no order of difficulty of magnitudes. Ideas don't leave their source, and it's all just forgiveness fodder for the classroom of our mind to undo the insanity of the ego.
It is exactly. So, do you want me to read? Let's see.
Sure. Yeah, we're in the middle of page 105 for people who have the print version.
Okay. So, now I turned the page. Okay. The second obstacle addresses the value of the body within the ego system, specifically the value of pain. Remember that the ego's goal is to keep the body real, because if the body is real, then the ego is real, and God is not. So the ego investment is in seeing that the source of pain lies in the body, not the mind. We find no clearer or more succinct statement of the role pain plays in the ego thought system of denying God than in Lesson 190, I Choose the Joy of God Instead of Pain. And Jesus says in the Lesson 190, pain is a sign illusions reign in place of truth. It demonstrates God is denied, confused fear, perceived as mad, and seen as traitor to himself. If God is real, there is no pain. If God is real, there is no pain. If pain is real, there is no God. For vengeance is not a part of love, and fear, denying love and using pain to prove that God is dead, has shown that death is victor over life. The body is the Son of God, corruptible in death, as mortal as the Father he has slain. So that was from Lesson 190, and those questions, if God is real, there is no pain, if pain is real, there is no God, well, those are statements, but that's kind of where the rubber meets the road here, is the reality of the experience that we're having, and if I believe that pain is real, if I believe that death is real, if I believe that anything that has to do with the body is real, then I'm declaring that God is dead and that death is victor over life. Oh, man, that's pretty crazy.
It really is. Do you want to go on, or should I go on?
I'll go on. Okay. So we shall also find, under the second obstacle, additional material that bears on the way Christianity has looked at Jesus. That is, its belief in sacrifice, which is the true source of pain. And this is really good that we're doing this, because this is something that confuses me a lot. And I think I'm probably not the only one. So this belief in pain and the reality of pain, reality of God is really, really good to understand. So he says from chapter 19, from the obstacles to peace, the second obstacle, we said that peace must first surmount the obstacle of your desire to get rid of it. Where the attraction of guilt holds sway, peace is not wanted. Peace is not wanted. You know, if I want to believe in guilt, if I want to see my own or someone else's guilt, that means that I have chosen that instead of peace. And so if I choose the pain instead of peace, then I'm not, why would I be surprised when I experience pain? You know, why would I be surprised when I'm suffering? And why would I blame God? But it's not knowing that I chose it that really makes the difference. So let's see how that happens. And he says, Ken says, that desire to get rid of peace gets expressed in the desire to attack, which is what reinforces guilt. Moreover, it is always one or the other, with no in-between. Peace and guilt, along with love and fear, as we have seen, are mutually exclusive states. And so that brings something very clear to me, that if I choose to attack, and as long as I choose to attack, I cannot have peace. And so, you know, if you look around, you say, well, how come I am, you know, so unhappy? Why am I not at peace? Well, all you have to look at is, what am I attacking? And, you know, I could be attacking the body and the state of the body. Maybe the body has an illness, you know. Maybe the body has a respiratory system that doesn't work like, you know, we think it should, you know, quote unquote, it should. Maybe someone has hurt me. Maybe someone, you know, took my money. Maybe the government is oppressive. Maybe these rules of the road when I'm driving that say stop at the light, maybe those are oppressive to me and I just want to go, go, go. You know, whatever it is that I'm objecting to and attacking in the world, which is what happens when you object to something, you're attacking it. Whenever I'm doing that, then I can't possibly be at peace. And so, you know, if you're not at peace, what are you attacking? What or who? And it is not just one thing, and it is not just one thing at one time. For me, it is hundreds of things all the time. You know, I'm attacking, you know, I was too hot and I took off my jacket and now I'm chilly. You know, something has to change. You know, and you can recognize attack always by the thought in your mind that something needs to change, that something is not perfect just the way it is. Yep. Right when you know that, you're attacking.
Yeah, the least little twinge of discomfort or annoyance is really a clue that we've chosen a thought system that makes the body real and makes pain real. And then the thing that ties into it, I think, that is really important, and it was kind of an aha moment for me when I first read it that kind of really clarified it, was in one of Gary Wright's first books, Artman Persa talk about some definitive statements, one of which is pain is a mental process. And that was like, oh, wow, that's a really and helpful insight, because it's like, you know, it's really the interpretation that we give sensations that, you know, and the fact that, you know, we believe that sensations are part of our identity because we think that's our experience, because we've so identified with body. So because we made up an entire universe to hang out in as separate selves in a massive dream, you know, we've so thoroughly identified it with, we think that it's a physical process because we think there's something physical. But as modern physics tells us, you know, matter isn't, you know, and doesn't. and so, you know, in other words, it's an illusory thing. You know, it's basically something that we've made up into a whole thing that really has no true substance of itself. Even on the level of form, you know, atoms are mostly empty space. You know, the individual, you know, corpuscular components, if you will, of what we think of as material matter are, you know, you examine them closely and they just dissolve into these little, you know, unimaginably small blobs of energy, you know, that morph back and forth and pop in and out of existence, you know, 10 to the 44th times per second. It's like this ephemeral, you know, empty stroboscopic hologram that we've made into because of our mind's ability to fabricate, and to, you know, just the power of the mind, but it's the power of our mind on the ego drug. We've made this enormously vast, unimaginably vast holographic dream to hide out in, thinking that there was a need for it, which is this unconscious but unfounded guilt. So anyway, it's all part of the just an absurd strategy, you know, and that's why I think, you know, Ken Wapnick's comment that it's not evil, sinful, or wicked, it's just silly, is just so profound, because when we see the world as a mechanism for denying truth, it's like, why would anyone do that? But it's only from that perspective that we have that gentle, forgiving awareness that's like, well, I don't need to do that anymore, and no one else does, and I can, by my example of choosing peace, you know, consciously or unconsciously, broadcast to the whole cosmos that choice is unnecessary. So,
yeah, and is that's the healing of your mind, when accepting of the atonement. Really, that's what that is all about. So when the mind is healed in that way, and you are no longer seeing the world as something to object to or to fight against or to be afraid of, and you're only seeing the world as being, you know, when Jesus says the body is a communication device, that includes the world. That's mm-hmm. not just the physical form body that I think I am. That every bit of the world I see is an extension of this body. It is my belief of what I am. And so, you know, it's giving that the power to keep me from seeing the reality of what I am and the truth of what I am and the belief in it, that again, it's all, you know, like, you know, my friend Joan Tolleson, I just mentioned, you know, has written a book, new book, and it's called Death, the End of Self-Improvement. And that's exactly what it is. The atonement is the end of self-improvement. I mean, there's no more, you know, it's the correction is made already, and we don't have to do anything to make it more correct or give it more anything. All we have to do is just accept it. So
the irony, of course, is that the true self, the capital S self, that the Course addresses and wants us to remember in favor of and ultimately abandoning the little s, small s self that, you know, gets us into so much imaginary mischief, you know, it doesn't need any improvement. It's perfect and it's innocent and complete and whole and healed eternally. And we've only through our imagination made up something that could be lacking or separate or apart or incomplete, you know, in that regard. So, I mean, that's the craziness of it all, isn't it? So in the world, there's all kinds of, you know, self-improvement and consciousness raising and you know, the bookshelves in the psychology department, most bookstores are lined with that stuff, let alone all the stuff online. And, you know, nothing wrong with any of that. It's just that ultimately we have to go beyond the separate self to recognize that the only way we're really going to be at peace is to identify with the capitalist self that we all share. And the Holy Spirit is really just a symbol of that awareness that we took with us into the dream, isn't it?
Exactly. And so that's a gift, you know, today's gift.
Exactly. Yeah. The Christ is that gift.
The Christ is that gift.
That shared awareness.
So... Let's see. The second where are we at?
You're just starting to read the next story.
Okay. All right. So, why don't I let you read?
Okay. The second obstacle that peace must flow across, and closely related to the first, is the belief that the body is valuable for what it offers. And obviously, this, now he's setting the tone for the whole chapter. For here's the attraction of guilt made manifest in the body and seen in it. Ken says, most of the time we think that the body offers us pleasure, but A Course in Miracles is teaching us that its gift is really pain. That's kind of a challenging one for a lot of people to wrap their minds around, but if you really think about it, the pleasure that is at the, anyone's expense or any kind of comparative thing ultimately has to be a smokescreen over the psychology and the mind of the ego, which is painful. So anyway, and Ken is going to, let me start that sentence over again. Most of the time we think the body offers us pleasure, but A Course in Miracles is teaching us that its gift is really pain. Pleasure and pain are opposite sides of the same coin because both serve to make the body real, since they are experienced within the body. If the body is real, then the thought that made it, the separation from God, must be real as well. And if the separation is real, then so is sin, and thus is guilt made real. However, the body is guilt's shadow. And so the thought of guilt in the mind will inevitably be manifest in the body by feelings of self-hatred or hatred of others who, quote, deserve to be guilty because of their sins. So it kind of ties into Arden and Peirce's commentary that, you know, that pain is a mental process because it ultimately derives from the unconscious but unfounded guilt that is the ego's stock in trade, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so that gives you a thought, though, that if I am experiencing pain, how and I know that it is a defense against the truth, and you know I have all these ideas that the healed mind doesn't suffer, you know Jesus tells us, and so experiencing pain is subjective, and it's not. You know, I broke my leg, and therefore, you know, the pain I'm experiencing is, you know, X level or whatever. Like when I broke my shoulder, yeah, I was feeling a lot of pain in the shoulder, but I also knew that, strangely enough, you know, when I finally, after gosh, it was you know hours and hours, like probably 15, 16 hours. Before I actually got into emergency room, you know, I had a lot of experiences from the time I broke my shoulder till the time I actually got into an emergency room. And during that time, I was experiencing great pain, but I was still operating and still able to function, and I really wasn't suffering. I wasn't afraid. And I just didn't know what was going to happen. And so then when I finally got into the emergency room and they started an IV, and the IV, they started, you know, they put like morphine into it. And after a while, I wasn't experiencing the pain at all anymore. And I was experiencing a different kind of awareness that came about from the drug. But in that moment, you know, it's very easy to see that, you know, they didn't do anything to my shoulder. They didn't, you know, fix my shoulder, repair it, you know, put the tendons back, whatever. They did nothing of that nature. They put a drug into my system that went to my brain and told my brain, hey, forget about that. That's not happening now.
Forget about it.
You're not experiencing that anymore, and I wasn't experiencing that anymore. And it's very clear to see that, you know, the pain itself was an expression of the idea that something in my body telling me, this is broken. But the pain is not necessary. Because it's not going to fix that part. It's going to keep me from doing things with that arm or, you know, whatever, you know, it's going to prevent me from hurting it any worse, but it's not going to fix it. And so, you know, I guess where I'm coming to is, you know, the pain was all in my head. You know, the pain was all in my mind.
Well, exactly. I mean, without the interpretation that we ascribe, we ascribe that capability to a brain, but it's really the mind that chooses one of two thought systems that determines whether or not you're in a state of pain, which includes what we think of as pleasure in the world, or peace. You know, it's really, you know, it's just this clear-cut dichotomy between the two thought systems, ultimately, but the ego muddies the water and says, no, there's pain and pleasure within the world, and the Holy Spirit says, nah, you're really, if you're not at peace, that's really, you know, that's really painful, and because that's really the decision to identify with something less than all of spirit.
Exactly. Yeah. And how what this is explaining here in this paragraph, in this chapter, really, is that the pain is an experience, this entire experience that I'm having as something other than spirit, something other than the Christ, the entire experience that I'm having. And so it can be psychological, it can be physical, and it can be, I mean, it's anything that has to do with my experience of the world that brings about pain. So
yeah. I think that's why he says in this course, you know, perception is an interpretation, not a fact, you know, and that's you know, a challenging thing to remember sometimes, but when we do, it's extremely helpful, isn't it?
It's it's experience changing. Yeah,
yes.
They shift your experience. So did you finish that paragraph?
I did.
Okay.
Do you want to read the next one?
All right, yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. So then another quote from chapter 19. This is the value you think peace would rob you of. This is what you believe that it would dispossess and leave you homeless. And it is this for which you would deny a home to peace. And then Ken comments, if we choose peace, then we are choosing against the body and guilt. And this obviously means we are choosing against pain. The ego teaches us that the body is our home, and so we have either the home of the ego or the home of peace. We cannot have both. At least not in the same instant anyway, right?
Right.
We can go back and forth in our minds very quickly. But
just like those atoms, in and out, in and out.
Yeah, exactly. Moreover, peace poses a great threat to the ego's thought, ego system. In its presence, there can be no guilt. And without guilt, the ego is vulnerable to, quote, attack, unquote, by the decision makers choosing against it and its individuality. Its whole defensive system would crumble, leaving the ego's illusory existence unprotected against the truth. And this, once again, is the ego's real fear. Therefore, the body's value rests in its offering, the ego a seemingly safe and secure home for its thought system, a defense which displaces the Holy Spirit's peace and God's love, leaving only separation and guilt as our identity. So I think the fact that we, you know, don't live in that insane thought system all the time is really another one of ego strategies, is that it basically says, well, when it sort of says, okay, I'll you know, look the other way, sort of thing, when we're choosing peace, and then I'll claim that as my own, you know. It's sort of like it, I don't know, at least that's kind of my theory, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
is that the ego doesn't really know what real peace is, but in the moments when we don't choose the ego, you know, it's sort of like the ego's taken offline and put on standby. But because we don't choose the ego system all the time, otherwise we'd go stark raving mad. You know, we try to mix the two things, and we don't realize that the peace that we do experience really has nothing to do with the ego's thought system. It has nothing to do with its one or the other duality, but really has to do only with that, you know, choosing against the insanity of its belief in separation.
Exactly. So let's see. Do you want me to go ahead and read?
Sure.
Okay. So you just read the quote.
The quote and the if we choose peace paragraph.
Okay, all right.
So now he resumes with this sacrifice
okay.
of quotes.
All right. So this again from the chapter 19, Obstacles to Peace. This quote unquote sacrifice you feel to be too great to make, too much to ask of you. Is it a sacrifice or a release? And Jesus is asking us a question that is pretty fundamental to our comprehension of this. While you were talking, I was reading these two sentences over and over, and asking the question, "What the heck? You know, what is this sacrifice that I feel is too great to make, and too much to ask of me?" And this, obviously, the sacrifice is quote unquote sacrifice is to give up this world, to let go of the things that I think are true about myself and the world, and
it's not even that. It's not even giving up the world. It's giving up our identification
right.
with our belief in the world, and our interpretations of the ego. About the world. That's all, which really are, you know, the whole thought system of sin, guilt, fear, death, basically the misery, where it has to give up the misery of ego's interpretations. And that's really, you know, why this rhetorical question, when we really think about it, strikes home. It's like, why would I be afraid to give up misery?
Right, right. And that's what he says. Is it a sacrifice or a release?
Mm-hmm.
And we've all had that, you know, situation where, you know, maybe we were in a relationship and the relationship was really over and not, you know, it could be with a friend, it could be with a lover, could be with a job, you know, you get to the point where you no longer are receiving from it what you need. Or you recognize that you're not receiving from what you need or whatever. And so the relationship is really over. But to actually let go of the relationship, to tell the person, you know, I don't want to be married to you anymore. Or to tell the job, I don't want to work here anymore. You know, that really comes from a place to be able to do that takes a real leap. You know, nobody goes into that without some trepidation, I believe. You know, there may be people who, you know, can do that. But for the most part, anything that we have an investment in, we are going to want to hold on to. And so the letting go of it or to releasing it just seems like too much. But then, you know, do you want to stay with somebody that, you know, doesn't, you know, put the toilet seat down or whatever, you know, I don't even know why, you know, you would want to separate from someone, because once you've got this, once you figure this out, you don't care anymore about what they do or don't do. You're just there with them. To recognize that, you know, it's not a sacrifice, it is a release. And it looks like the end of our time. Oh my gosh.
Whoosh, it went by quickly, didn't it?
It went by quickly. But we got quite a bit through. We got maybe a couple pages. I don't know.
A couple pages, yeah.
Yay.
That's our usual.
That's, yeah, pretty good. So I'm going to put a bookmark here. And thank you so much, Bruce Rawls, for
likewise, Lynn Johnson.
Being my mighty companion, hanging out here with me on Saturday mornings. And, you know, I spend more time with you than I do with a lot of people I know personally. And that I'm here, you know, that's in my area. So.
Same here.
All right. Well, I love you, Bruce, and I will talk to you next week and let go of the mic and turn it over to you, Carrie. And Bruce, do you need to run off?